It's time to become a member of Playvolution HQ and Explorations Early Learning. There's a free option and three paid patron level options. All come with free stuff and ongoing automatic training and merch discounts. For as little as a dollar a month, you can become a patron. That supports our work and you get premium stuff like early access to fresh podcast episodes. Go to explorationsearlylearning.com/membership or click the link in this episode's description to learn more. All the cool listeners are doing it. On with the show. Welcome to Child Care Viral Podcast. Jeff John Searle. That's the way I can do introduction anymore. Change it. I got to start over again. Welcome to the Child Care Barn. Okay, we're going to try once again. I'm so embarrassed. Hey, listeners, this is a high stakes episode. We've got a special guest.
Sorry, so breaking it.
Oh no! I hope it's okay.
So I got stuff going on here too. I'm sorry you're having trouble, but I got birds like mashing themselves into my windows.
Welcome to the Child Care Bar and Grill Podcast, the world's longest running and most prolific early learning podcast with the words bar and grill in the title. I'm Jeff Johnson, coming from upstairs studio in the snuggery along the Gulf of Mexico. With me, a very special guest, a first timer. We've got Stephanie Galloway. How you doing, Stephanie?
I'm doing well, Jeff. How are you doing?
I'm delightful, other than not remembering the introduction to a podcast we've done just about 1,000 episodes of. But, you know, in my favor, I changed it a little bit ago. And for the first dozen times I did the new intro, I had it up here on the screen and I thought I could do it without it this time. So Stephanie is the author of Happily Ever Resilient, Using Fairy Tales to Nurture Children Through Adversity. Stephanie showed up on my radar. Let me see if I got the chronology right. You were on a training that I did for a friend of the show, co-host Kristen Peterson, and you reached out with some kind words and you were kind enough to send me a copy of the book, and we've emailed some since then, and I invited any on the show because I'm always looking for interesting and fun people to talk about interesting and fun stuff. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I like to play. I like fairy tales. And I've been in early childhood. I actually figured out this will be my 60th year in early childhood education because I had my first preschool on my back porch when I was 9 and had kids like playing and doing all this stuff. So I'm a lifer. I've done all kinds of things. I've done lots and lots of work with kids, both in childcare settings and early elementary school, middle school, worked with adjudicated teens, ended early intervention and ended up public library and ended up my career. The last 20 years, I taught early childhood at two different community colleges in Pennsylvania. And so that's the stuff I've done. And I think that play and storytelling and fairy tales have been the thread that have woven it all together. I'm now happily ever retired-ish, but I'm finding it really hard not to keep doing the work that I'm so passionate about. And that's why I do things like go to online conferences and go to conferences and keep reading and keep listening to podcasts, because I don't think I can ever give up wanting the best for kids and feeling that the battle that I thought would be over to get people to understand play. God,
it seems like has there been any progress?
Thinking so, but then I go into an early childhood classroom and go, I think there is. I think that with neuroscience kicking in and resilience and social emotional learning and early childhood mental health and all of those have become, I think they're kind of like the magic key that will get people to unlock what they have known all along, which is that children learn, develop, are become joyful through play and through exploration. And I'm hoping that, I've often said that whatever means we use to get people to understand how vital play is and how important freedom is and creativity, I have no shame. I will whip out those standards if I can find the standard that says, yeah, actually the child needs to be doing exactly this, which is playing. And so I'm hoping that the more hard science that is supporting what we've known theoretically and practically and just from watching children forever, it's going to help move the needle, I hope.
I hope. And my only fear there is it's always about the implementation, right? I mean, the neuroscience has been, I remember back when Clinton was in office and they did their early childhood forum at the White House. And out of that grew a lot of talk about neuroscience, that we would be able to stop teens smoking because we would give them the right stimulus at the right time because of the neuroscience. And so a lot of times these very broad, dreamlike, wishful ideas come out of the science, and often the way journalists kind of report on that kind of stuff is kind of scary. But there is a lot of good information out there, and if we could filter it into the classroom, I think what you're talking about is absolutely right. It's just that getting it into the classroom for day-to-day practice where we struggle, huh?
I agree. And I guess I've thought for a long time, I mean, before the neuroscience became what it is. And I mean, I connect the dots all the time, but I've always connected dots with theory and actual practical. I mean, I've been like the anti-calendar, all the stuff that's now like, ooh, this is, don't do calendar time. Well, you know what? Like, I've been shouting that for 50 years. And because the theory's there, we know calendar time is, but making that transition into a classroom part, I wonder sometimes if we don't give early childhood educators or people who work with young children the credit for being able to understand that, like, this is what neuroscience is in, and this is what the theory is, and here's what it looks like. I don't know if. To me, there's been, people know the theory and understand the theory, and then they're the practitioners who know what that looks like in the classroom, or who know what they think they want things to happen in the classroom. And I don't see as much connecting the dots, and I'm not sure why that's so hard. I don't know. I mean, I've certainly have tried to do it, and I know it's tough. People are like, I don't like theory. I know what, but I think that the theory and the science somehow need to be shared in a way that honors and respects the practice without it feeling like it's rules. And it's just a new lens.
Yeah. It's, well, look, it's going to keep us in business. I mean, we're not going to get everything solved. This podcast isn't going to end anytime soon, and I'm not going to stop doing trainings anytime soon because everything is fixed. That's for sure. It's good to have job security in a time of creeping AI, I guess. Stephanie, listen to this. This is the thing I'm planning. I've got, you know, there's just about 1,000 episodes of this show, figure half an hour each. So that's, I'm not really good at the math. That's like 500 hours of podcast episodes. And then I wrote some books, and I've got some stuff on the websites. And so I'm thinking about a Jeff AI or a childcare bar and grill AI. And then you just type into it. And then there, the podcast would kind of probably sway it. Most answers would probably talk about dogs or dolphins for a while, but eventually you might get to some distorted answer about play or early learning. So I think we'll get another 1,000 episodes of the show in, and we'll have a good bunch of data to scrape. What do you think about that?
That sounds great. And would you show up as like a little like avatar guy?
Total Princess Leia with a hologram right there on your kitchen table, I think is what the plan is. I gotta keep I'm going in. For a couple of, because I'm only about halfway in to the timeline you've put together. So I figure if I can put another 30 years of creating content, we'll have a very interesting, although probably skewed AI out there for early learning at some point.
I think your website is so, so rich and is so fascinating. I mean, I feel like going down a rabbit hole, I go down yours.
Great. I appreciate that. Mostly it just keeps me off the streets. It's just a public good in that way. So let's talk a little bit about the book. I haven't read cover to cover, but I've browsed and picked up snippets. And so where did it, where, I mean, it's it, books are my experience is like, I, look, I've never given birth for real. I've attended a couple. Writing a book is like giving birth in my experience, though. So where was the book conceived? Where did you give birth to it? Tell us all about
that. Well,
let's okay, dive into
yeah
it.
So the short version of that is that my husband was suffering from substance use disorders, and I went to treatment to a family program when he was in treatment, and they said, look, it was a multi-generational program, and they said look at all these kids here. So there were young, you know, teenagers, middle school kids who were there to have their addictions treated, and then there were old people, and he said, where were their teachers? And I got goosebumps because I'd spent my whole life in education, in public education, childcare, blah, 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 blah. Like I've done everything because I have short attention span, I guess. And always worked with kids, always had professional development, always read, blah, blah, blah. And I'd never had a second, it hit me, I'd never had one second of professional development about the impact of substance use disorders on young children. And so I looked at Mike at the time and I was like, well, I'm a teacher. He was like, really? good job. You figured out what you were. And then he passed away from the disease.
Oh,
and so that, thanks. But that I just knew that I needed to figure out why weren't we talking about it? And I had learned a lot just from being married to him. But I wanted to know more. And so instead, I knew I had the self-discipline of a flea. And I thought, well, you've always thought you'd like to go back and get your doctorate someday. And now you can. You have nobody to take care of except for yourself and a dog. So maybe you could go into a doctoral program and figure out if you had just missed the boat on all this professional development or if it really was an issue. And so I started back at age 59, I started to get my doctorate at Walden University and had very clear intentions from day one that I was going to learn about this disease and its impact on kids and what to do about it and how to help teachers connect those dots. So what could you do in a classroom? And so I jumped in. I learned about resilience, which I think is the magic beans that is we all need to be thinking a lot more about. And now everybody's talking about resilience, which is great. In 2013, they weren't. It was more science-y. And I found a book called The Ordinary Magic of Resilience, which is my favorite theory of resilience and based on Harvard's used it for their Center on the Developing Child. So it's got all this like good cred, but the word magic, that's what got me. It was in the title. And I thought, this is great. And one of the first quotes was about fairy tales, which I've always loved and did my master's thesis on social and emotional development and children, young children and fairy tales. And so when it came time to do my dissertation, I knew I wanted to look at resilience. And a friend of mine said, you better pick out something that you really want to, like you really love, because you it's going to be a lot of work and you're teaching full time and you're the department head and you're You get cranky when you're not happy and you're not playing. So what do you love? And I said, well, I love fairy tales. And so I went to my chair and I said, I think I want to do my dissertation on fairy tales and resilience. And he said, what the actual F? And I said, he said, how? I said, I don't know. I'm going to try it. And so I did. And they were very supportive. They kind of said, she's a whack job, let her go off and do her own thing. And what I learned was that fairy tales are perfect. I did a content analysis on looking for these specific themes or protective factors for resilience in fairy tales. And I did fairy tales from across the world. I did like 9 basic stories that my students had chosen as the ones that they did their projects on the most, and my college students. And I did this whole like serious scholarly, like picking up fairy tales from different cultures. But I got all the continents. I got, 22 different, completely different cultures of the variants. And the resilience, the protective factors are there. The ones that have been identified by the researchers, as if kids have these kinds of experiences, there's a better chance that they will develop resilience, which will help to offset mental illness, substance use disorders, and being able to bounce back from the bad stuff, whether it's climbing up a slide and falling down, or, you know, like having your puppy dog run away. I mean, like, everybody needs resilience, and the fairy tales had it all in there. So my intention was never to write a dissertation, because nobody reads dissertations. We know this. And I kept saying, well, couldn't I do a website? Couldn't I do this? And they were like, nah, I'm going to do a dissertation. So as soon as I got done, I started thinking, okay, so I learned all this great stuff. I think it's relevant. I tied in storytelling, Vivian Paley. I like got the play. I got all the things I'm passionate about. I worked in all of the research. So what am I going to do with all of this crap? How do I get it into the hands of people who actually need it, who are early childhood educators? And I decided I'd try seeing if somebody would publish it, if I could write it as a book. And so that's
a lot better than putting it on a shelf and letting it get dusty.
Well, yeah, I've got several dusty presentation. Yeah, because it doesn't matter. They kept saying, well, why don't you write scholarly law articles? And I said, because nobody freaking reads scholarly articles except for other scholars. Like, I don't care. I don't need to be like a scholar. I don't want to be a scholar. I want to play. I want teachers to play and make the world more joyful for children. And so how do I do that? And so the book was what I Red Leaf Press, like I sent in a proposal. They said, this is really interesting. Like, let's talk. And why don't you write it? And that was in February of 2020. And so I had a pandemic project. I retired, moved out into a different state, and wrote a book. And
well, I mean, people have done worse things in their pandemic time.
Yeah. So it worked out well. It kept me occupied when I had no humans. And yeah, so that's how the book came about. And what I found is that people, but I think everybody needs to know about resilience. And I found that a lot of the professional development that I've been tapping into on resilience and stuff I've read is just real general. And I think we need something to kind of hang on to. And the protective factors to me make a lot of sense. They're things that are part of good high quality early childhood. They're part of play. They're part of all of the things that we want to do with children. And it's just connecting the dots. I'm hoping that in the stuff that I put out there with the book, that people connect the dots, and that fairy tales are this wonderful source of challenge. I mean, like, everybody talks about the happy ever after, but you don't get to the happy ever after until you got some dragons and some real obstacles that fairy tale characters have to use their wits and their self-regulation and their, you know, like overcoming all kinds of their own fears to get to that happy ever after. And I think we don't use fairy tales nearly as much with children as I think we should. And I know you and I have had a couple of little conversations about that. And so I'm hoping to help people.
That gory stuff in the middle, the dragons and the poisonings and the deaths and all of that, that's the process. So for me, the happily ever after is the finished product. And the process is that path, that walk through the dark and scary forest or whatever mm-hmm. it is. And just like arts and crafts, we want to focus on the process instead of the finished product. And I mean, Dr. Peter Gray, his five conditions of play, he talks about the importance of process there. And so I think one of the struggles with me with fairy tales is so many versions that kids are seeing have been so sanitized that they take out they eviscerate the things yeah. and take out that struggle, and all we end up with is the beginning, a little bump in the road, and then the happily ever after. But we lose a lot of the depth and value in the middle. Am I off base there? Or?
No, I agree 1,000%. I actually just heard attended an online workshop, and the person who was giving it, I have tremendous respect for, but she was like, oh, you know, we don't want anything violent in these stories. And I'm like, I mean, kids, when I was teaching kindergarten, I read Peter and the Wolf. Like, it was on a record and it was a long mm-hmm. time ago, and, you know, actual vinyl go right around, and they were listening to it. And at the end, and Peter and the Wolf is not really a fairy tale, but it's kind of quasi in that area. And in the end, they took the wolf to the zoo, and the kids just looked at me, and I had not listened to the record before. I knew the story. He didn't get taken to the zoo. They offed him. I mean, he was like eating the ducks. Like, how could you not do something horrible to this mean, horrible wolf? And the kids were like, what? They were furious. And I thought, this record came from my reading program for this stupid district, and it's blah, da, da. And so I went to the library and tried to find the real Peter and the Wolf.
The old version.
All of them are like that. He is taken to the zoo in every one. And since that time, which was a long time, it told me children's understanding of justice is that when you do bad things happen. there's yeah. moral, that's part of their development. And they don't want the sanitized versions of these things. They need to know that there's an order in the world to feel safe. And that I've asked many, many adults, how does the story end? I know, great cocktail party. Like, by the way, do you know the story of Peter and the Wolf? What happens to the wolf in the end? And almost 201, everybody says, well, I mean, the hunter kills the wolf. And I'm like, no, he doesn't. Whip the book out. And I think that we are to me, fairy tales are like the risky play of children's literature. We don't want kids to get hurt. We don't want them to get scared, but we are depriving them of the opportunity to realize that they are more than capable of figuring out how to overcome scary things.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, one of the big values I see in rough and tumble play, for example, or superhero play, is the opportunity to go into those dark places like kids go with fairy tales. And one of the reasons so many programs shy away from that kind of play is we can't be violent. We can't be killing, that kind of stuff. But they don't understand that one of the ways we learn not to be violent is to take on those personas, to play play at being the bad guy. The way we learn to be the good guy is to play at being the bad guy. It's superimposing yourself on this other character. It sounds a lot deeper and a lot more complicated than we get when we would give the average 3.5-year-old credit for being able to manage. But that's exactly what kids are doing when they're engaged in those types of play, or when they're listening to real old school fairy tales.
Yeah, no, I think there's some really fascinating neuroscience, and I put it in my book, but I didn't get into any depth, but that actually looked not at children, but at adults listening to fantasy stories, and that your brain actually goes through the same, if you're encountering a dragon in a story, it's the same as if you're encountering a stressful event in real life. But because the stories give you that resolution, then all your neurotransmitters like calm back down and you come out with a happy resolution, and it builds those neural pathways that allow us to recognize that if bad things happen, we are able to overcome them and figure it out. And it's the same thing happens with kids. I mean, I don't know why we would not want them to have the experience of that. And rough and tumble play, I mean, to me, it's the primary way to build self-regulation. Because, you know, if you're having fun and somebody gets hurt, it's going to be stopped by an adult.
Yeah.
And so they get right to that edge, and then they can pull back. And like, without giving them that opportunity to do that and to practice that, I don't think that they're not developing self-regulation, and that causes really huge problems across the board. And these kinds of experiences are ones that prior generations had plenty of opportunity to develop self-regulation away from the watchful eyes of parents and teachers, and they just did it. They played through their play, through the books that they read, the stories that they experienced, and we've just sanitized childhood to the point where they're not able to often figure out what it is to be human in a world that isn't always kind and gentle.
Yeah, yeah. And if you read the news, you can never not find articles about tweenagers and teens and all of the stuff they're doing to hurt themselves, the rise in suicides, the rise in anxiety, the rise in casual drug use, the rise in self-harming, all of this. And some of that was sped up during the joyous plague years that we just experienced. But that was the way things were trending before that. And it's because I can't stand here and prove it, but I think we were, the way we've broken early childhood is leading to a lot of hurt and broken to some degree young people. And that's kind of a sad place to be.
It is. And I agree 1,000%. I mean, I think that's one reason why, I mean, I could retire, really retire, and not do any of this, but I can't. We need to keep calling out and changing early childhood to honor what childhood is supposed to be. And that is not an idyllic, happy, innocent time. I mean, you know, we have this like nothing, kids, the world's crazy. and we're putting kids, we're sending kids out there to deal with an unkind, crazy world without any of the skills they need, because we're not even letting them climb up the freaking slides. I mean, yeah. You know, like, we don't want them, you know, rough and tumble play, like we don't want them to have conflict. Like, we'll solve their problems so they won't have conflict. We'll take away the blocks when somebody bashes into them, because we don't want them to fight over them or get hit over the head. And it's kind of like, so where are they going to learn the skills?
Stephanie, I've been reviewing I collected about 120 now. I've got in my collection of program handbooks, and I've been reviewing them for some projects I'm working on building resources for writing policies and procedures. But I was reading one the other day that went into great detail about using timeout with basically infants and toddlers, 1 and 2 year olds. And so even at those very early ages, there are programs out there are, you know, if kids are being too wild and throwing and climbing on things, you got to give them that time out, Cher. You don't build a lot of brain connections, a lot of neural pathways or resilience when you're spending all your time sedentary in the toddler room. I was thinking, why don't you give us a elevator pitch or elevator definition of resilience? We're going up 42 flights. We're in Las Vegas. We're in a casino. We're going to a high stakes poker game in the penthouse, and you're talking to me about resilience. What would your definition be?
Short definition of resilience is our ability to overcome obstacles and adversity. That's the shortest one that I can come up with. What I think is important is to recognize that there are specific experiences, protective factors for resilience that are critical, and that when we have them, we are able to be more resilient. First one is relationships. We all need relationships, whether we are a two-year-old who needs a primary caregiver, but also other important adults in their lives and peers. Peer relationships are important too. We're probably at the 20th floor.
Let me pause right there. I got another handbook experience for you. Tell me how this works out for relationships. I read a handbook the other day where their transition from room to room, you know, how centers do moving kids around. They did it. Each child was transitioned. Their plan was to transition each child twice a year. From room to room, although they might do it more often if they felt that was necessary. And so every 6 months about, you are being taken away from somebody who's been your caregiver for half a year, just long enough for you to start getting comfortable, and all your peers and popped into a room of strangers, and you got to start all over again. And just when you start settling in, it's time to move to another room. How's that for building relationships?
I mean, you know, Jeff, that sucks. That doesn't build relationships. And that's, you know, I mean, there are a lot of things. Even transitioning kids once a year is
too much, according to what the research seems to indicate. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, even when I taught elementary school, so even older kids, I begged to let me loop. Because I knew that this group of children would do better with me as 2 years in a row than they would just one. I mean, we know that from our, as adults, like who are our best friends? They're people we've known for a long time, of course. I think it takes teachers, we talk about kids developing relationships with teachers, but teachers, it takes teachers a long time to understand each child and to know what their interests are and what their temperament is. And so that's one of the things that we do that's, we know that
breaks relationships. So what's the next factor?
Okay. Next factor is initiative, which can be broken down into lots of different variables, usually like problem solving. Basically, initiative is I have a great idea and I know I can act on it and do something with it and give it a try. So there's risk taking and motivation to succeed and self-efficacy, all those nice big words. But basically, to me, initiative is giving children the opportunities to choose and to play, where they play, what they play, who they play with, what they make. I mean, it's the foundation of process art. It's the foundation of all of the good things that we know that we should, many of us are doing with children, because putting together a cookie cutter piece of art means what the message for a child is. You give me the pieces, you give me the model, you tell me to put them where I do and I will do it. And I don't, that's not my idea. Like,
yeah, Yeah, giving them a little bit of agency. Those craptivities. Craptivities is the term we use for that here at the Child Care Bar and Grill. You don't have any of that, and that goes that lack of agency is just pernicious in early learning settings. It's all about lockstep movement and rigor and control, and everybody standing in a straight line. And if a child exerts a little bit of initiative in how they want to interact with the world, climbing up the slide, like you mentioned earlier, or seeing if blocks can fly or whatever it is, instead of figure out ways to support and see the value in that, we oftentimes look for ways to shut it down and then ways to punish the child, although we call it discipline, and we wouldn't think about calling it punishment, which is exactly what it is.
What it is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we're not doing too well here with the resilience factors, are we now? Third one is kind of it overlaps kind of two and four, but the executive function skills, so all your prefrontal cortex stuff. Cognitive flexibility, being able to see lots and lots of possibilities. Working memory, being able to understand how to keep in mind what you're doing while you're doing it. And what they call inhibitory control, which is like self-regulation, but it's kind of like being able to kind of block out the things that you shouldn't be paying attention to and focus on continuing to do what you should be doing. Again, like, where do you learn that stuff? Well, you learn it through play. You learn it through interacting with other people. You're learning it through like building a block structure that has never been built before, because that's cognitive flexibility. Loose parts to me are like, hello. Sure. That is, you know, you talk about being able to see possibilities in a bunch of junk. That is loose parts, and that is executive functioning. And we need that doesn't come fully online until age 25. And so preschoolers, young children are at the very beginning stages of it. We need to do a lot of things to support them, but we, you know, like being able to let a child like learn how to use watercolors even. There's a process that you go through before you get to the creativity part. And are we spending the time teaching children these basic processes, how to pour your own juice into a cup with a small pitcher, like simple stuff is developing the neurology of the prefrontal cortex. And again, that's what is your kind of air traffic controller of the brain. So when we hear about like all of the horrible violence of impulsive violence that going in and shooting up people, that's what's not working. It's the emotion centers, our amygdala and limbic brain are like over hijacking the prefrontal cortex. So you got to get a pretty strong prefrontal cortex. And a lot of that is through play and through all of those kinds of activities.
Not worksheets. We couldn't do some executive function worksheets.
I'll tell you something. 30 years ago, I saw a handout that said worksheets don't build neurons. And like, that was a long time ago before we even really knew what neurons were. And no worksheets
for. So, hey, listeners, if you've got a stack of executive function worksheets in your teacher closet, you might want to bring those to the craft area and let the kids use the blank backside to draw pictures. What's number? No, that was number four.
That was number three. Number four is self-regulation. And that's a term everybody knows about, self-regulation, because we know when kids don't have it, and that's the source of all of our problems in early childhood education. And we do very little to help children actually develop self-regulation. Like long ago, Vygotsky talked about self-regulation. Just some of the research that has been done since then is like movement. Like children have to first regulate their bodies before they can regulate their emotions or their thinking. And we have eliminated so much movement from our early childhood programs. Kids aren't going outside. They're not having to do things that require them to balance. I mean, I'm working on something with Three Billy Goats Gruff, and like walking the bridge It was something that I always did with preschoolers. We walked blocks, we walked tape, we walked rocks, we walked stumps, we walked all of those things, which give children the opportunity to regulate their bodies, to think about where their body is in space and to regulate it. And you walk into early childhood programs today, and that's like everybody had a bridge back. Everybody had bridges, and you flip it over and it was a rowboat, and you would self-regulate because you couldn't tip the boat over.
Had the classroom troll living under it. That was kind of weird, but that was just the custodian, we found out a couple years later, but I don't know why he was sleeping under that classroom bridge, but there's so much of those opportunities, and yet kids are subjugated to crisscross applesauce.
Yeah.
And required to listen to lectures about self-regulation. So yeah. it seems kind of counterproductive.
It does. And I don't know how, I don't understand why we think that what we do is external regulation. Crisscross applesauce, sitting quietly, you know, zip your lips. I mean, my God, like ever since I saw Beetlejuice, like every time I hear that, I go crazy. That's all external. It's not helping children to develop those internal self-regulating skills that they need. And there are plenty of things we can do that will help them to do that, including movement, including, honestly, giving them things that they're interested in doing. We're all much better regulated if we're doing things that bring us happiness and pleasure.
Shocking. That's shocking.
I know. See, this is what I mean. I was like, the words have changed, but the ideas are the same. And we just, why don't people get them? We keep changing the words. So those are the protective factors for resilience that have been found by many, many researchers. Ann Mastin wrote the book Ordinary Magic, and so she's written a lot about it. Harvard basically took her model and has like plugged in all of the neuroscience stuff. And so when people have those protective factors, experiences, many, many, many experiences that produce those protective factors, they're better able to handle stress and the toxic stress that comes about and any adversity, whether it's very small that many children experience or the major ones. And to me, it's kind of like a no-brainer. Then these are all woven into what we call developmentally appropriate practice. I mean, they are. It's like if you go into a high quality early childhood program, a magical program, like I'm sure your program was, children are developing, are doing all of those things, and they are developing resilience. If you go into a home situation, like that's what happens. If it's a supportive family that like lets their kids go out and like eat worms.
I recorded a couple days ago with co-host Carol, and she's got a couple elementary age daughters, and she's been trying to step back as a worrying mom a little bit more. And she told a story about how her youngest, they'd been at a water park, and her youngest was in the wave pool, and she was getting in a little bit deep, and the waves are crashing, and Carol, mom, is wanting to tell her to, you know, watch out and be careful. And she decides, she takes a breath and she pauses for a second, and she watches her daughter go in a little bit deep and realize, oh, this is a little bit too deep for me. I'm going to take a couple steps backwards so the waves aren't hitting me as violently. And then she does that, and mom breathes a sigh of relief, and daughter goes on playing, and time goes by, and a little bit later she goes a little bit deeper in, and a little bit later she goes in a little bit deeper in, and she's just having this experience of finding her own edge and what she's comfortable with. And those simple little experiences, when the adults stand back a little bit and let kids figure things out, are vital for learning some of these factors, aren't they?
I agree 1,000%. That's the best compliment my daughter has ever given me was, I know she was like in her mid 20s and she was introducing me to somebody and she said, my mom was a free range mom. And I was like, really? Wow. Well, thank you.
But I was out of the yard laying eggs.
That's why I was like, really? But I think that's it, isn't it? I mean, that's what we have to give kids the opportunities to find those edges.
Yeah.
I mean, and they will. I mean, I think we dishonor children when we think that they need us to tell them how to stay safe every minute of the day because they don't. I mean, we're not going to like put them in a room of broken glass and say, okay, good luck. But normal risks is what children are lacking. It's definitely in early childhood programs and across the board. And I think that is really, I mean, I think Peter Gray has written about the mental health crisis that we are in part because of, as you've said, we're not giving children the opportunity to play, to take risks, to find their own limits. And so they don't, and it's really having an impact on their neurology, which is a lot harder to catch up fast with.
So why are adults, parents, programs so reluctant to allow kids these experiences?
I mean, I have unkind words.
Okay,
I have very judgmental words to say, but I won't say those.
Look, this show is all about what the conversations you'd have at a bar and grill. I mean, so assume you've had a couple cocktails by now. Speak your mind.
Okay. So I'll start with the positive, which is I do truly believe I've never met a parent, and I work with some kids, some really hardcore adjudicated teenage kids who and I worked with their parents and I never met a parent that didn't truly want the best for their child. And I think we need to start, and the same thing with teachers. We need to start with that assumption that people want the best for their children and they want to protect them and they want to keep them safe and healthy and have a wonderful life. I mean, I don't dishonor people's intentions. But I think that people don't understand often what children need to develop. I mean, sure. That they need to take risks, that they need to be able to explore and to take initiative and to act on their own ideas. And I think for childcare, the law, people are every time I mention anything like, you know, yes, kids should be cutting with knives at the age of three. You should give them real knives because who can cut with a freaking plastic knife? Absolutely. If you want a child to cut a potato, don't give them a plastic knife. They don't work. You don't. Yeah. You wouldn't use one and you know how to cut. So give them sharp scissors, give them those things. And everybody goes, oh, well, we need the regs. We will be sued. And I think that they're, you know, like probably that, I don't know if it's as valid as people think it is. I don't know how many childcare centers get sued, but certainly
I've done my own research on this because I talk about this. And I mean, back before I became a hermit and started doing most of my trainings online, I'd go out to actual real conferences. But I'd ask rooms of 200, 300, 400, 500 people about this. How many of your programs have been sued because you let children take risks? And most of the time, not a single hand would go up. And every once in a while, a hand would go up and the response, I would follow up and, you know, what happened. And just about every single time, it was found in favor of the risk taking. And if a program was found negligent, it was generally because a single person made a bad choice and was actually being negligent. But programs right. that are thoughtful about things like risk taking and do benefit risk assessments and have those on file so they can point to the fact that they've thought through this. Do a great job of defending and standing up for and avoiding those kind of situations. Because, I mean, part of my experience is that most parents seem to be a lot more cool with some of these resilience building activities than a lot of programs are, or they might not admit it because they feel they're being judged by the programs. And so they can't say, well, why don't you just let them play Batman? Because they put themselves back, they turn themselves back into children when they're talking to that teacher authority figure, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I think parents sometimes have a hard time advocating, but yeah, there is that fear of litigation that I think is really unfounded from my informal investigation.
Yeah. And that's, you know, like, teaching at community college, most of my students were already in the field. And so that gave me a huge pool of urban centers, teachers who ranged in age from 18 to, you know, 50, 60. Mm-hmm. And that just kept coming up. I mean, anytime that I'd come up with an idea that they didn't like, they'd be like, ah, no, the regs and the suing and the parents. And I'm like, you know what, you know, do you want to learn what best practice is? Because that's, I thought, why you were here. And I'm mm-hmm. just, I can give you what we know about child development and why these things are so important. And here's some words to use with parents, because I think that's the other piece that we often don't communicate effectively with parents about the why. I mean, yeah. if we go with the assumption that parents really do want the best for their kids, and if we say this is resilience building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The way I frame it is parents want the best for their kids, but they generally don't know exactly what that looks like. And mm-hmm. part of our job becomes helping them see that. One of the reasons I'm doing this deep dive into handbooks is I'm trying to see how programs explain play and risk-taking and these kind of things to parents as they're onboarding them into the program. And most of them don't. In my mind, our handbooks and program policies that we share with parents and staff should be very clear about, I mean, a policy is this is what we do here, and a procedure is this is how we do it. And they don't really go into great depth, or seldom don't even mention the reason, you know, we support risk taking because blah 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 mm-hmm. blah.
Right.
It's not mentioned. And in fact, most of them spend more time on the behavior management. This is what we're going to do with your kid if they do any risk taking. Right. We're going to try to redirect them, and then we're going to talk to them. We're going to talk to your barely verbal toddler about their horrible behavior because they were climbing things, and then we're going to put them in timeout instead of saying, hey, we value risk taking, and here's what we do to keep kids safe, but here's why we want it to happen, because it builds their damn brains. I you probably want to word it different in your handbook.
That was
just went off on a tangent. I apologize, but
no, I think when you said at the beginning, like, well, have things changed, you know, and I there's so many pieces, and I think that the policy and procedure piece is one that really has changed. It has gotten much more stringent and rigid and like off track for what we know about what's good for kids in the years that I've been in the field. But the communication with parents, like, I mean, it's almost like, well, we don't respect children enough to let them take risks, and we don't respect parents enough to be able to say, look, this is the deal. Like, you want your kid, we know you love your kids. They're going to need to be taking risks. At our center, we believe in using like the best knowledge that is available on Absolutely. On how to help kids grow brains. And we'll tell you that what we're doing, and we'll explain it to you, and rather than just like being afraid that you're going to sue us if your child gets a splinter in their freaking finger.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's that respect across all levels that is sometimes, it seems like it's harder for people to figure out how to communicate that.
And it's never been easier. There've never been so many pathways to communicating with parents as we have now. So that's, but again, that's not really the job of early learning programs. That, I mean, I don't think it's something that staff get trained up on, is how to effectively communicate these things to parents. And so it's almost like programs need to have a PR person that's sharing this information for them, because it could be done so much more effectively than it is in a lot of situations. But I think a lot of, like you said, a lot of times staff struggle with implementing these things as well, because of the same lack of knowledge that parents experience, because some people find their way into this profession accidentally. And it takes a good, 15 or 20 years before you start feeling confident. That was my experience. You got to build up. You got to build
I
up.
I mean, some... I still don't.
Yeah, sure.
I was like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna like talk to a human being about like what I spent the last 10 million years learning about. Oh, I'm afraid.
I was talking to somebody the other day that when we were 19, we felt like we knew everything, and now we feel like we don't know anything, and it's unsettling. But I think another reason that we have a problem with these things being implemented in classrooms is rough and tumble play and loose parts and letting kids solve their own problems and make mistakes and have emotions and experiences. It's a lot more messy than circle time and controlled group activities and craptivities and that. And so it feels a lot more chaotic maybe and uncomfortable mm-hmm. for the adults. And so they shy away from it for that way, I think, to some extent.
I think that's a great point. And I know it certainly was in my teaching. I dealt with that all the time because I didn't care. I mean, I guess because I went into teaching a really different path than a lot of people, and came into it and understanding the theory and people called me when Piaget died. They were like, oh, we were so sorry for your loss. I mean, I really threw myself into the theory and what in child development rather than teaching. And so my classrooms always were based on what I thought was best practice for child development. And they were always messy and they were always noisy. And parents had an issue, some in public school parents had an issue with it sometimes, you know, fellow teachers did. And I felt I had the resilience, I had the courage, I had the confidence that what I was doing was right for the kids. And that was all I really cared about. But I think that being able to articulate it and how it is so critical. I mean, we just have to figure out different ways of sharing that and being able to give, I don't think teachers feel as though they have self-efficacy and agency to do what they want to do in their classrooms often. I think that their own resilience is diminished.
Honestly, partly because some of them didn't have those experiences in their early years.
Right. They did. I mean, I think that's really true. I think there's tons,
especially
of
for some younger, for some current younger teachers just coming into the profession. That's something I think they struggle with.
Right. And I think, but it's tell us that what we remember about or how, like who we are as teachers often goes back to how we were taught.
Sure.
And what does a teacher look like? We don't have memories of our early childhood teachers. If people went to early childhood programs, we remember elementary school. And I think a lot of teachers have this, I need to be in control and I mm-hmm. need to do this. And this is what a teacher, I mean, I think that's why circle time has never petered out. it's the thing you do in early childhood that feels the most like being a teacher. And like, how do we shift that? I mean, I was in teacher education, so like I tried really hard, but it's tough to crack those stereotypes.
I just had this thought, is the reason was circle time so alien to us at the time when we were exposed to it for the first time, that it really stuck in our heads. And then we carry that memory with us because it was anchored there. Because look, I go off to kindergarten and we're sitting there in a half circle and we're sitting on carpet squares and there's this laminated calendar up there. Nowhere in the 5 years of my life before that did I experience anything like that, where I had to sit still with my hands to myself. And so of course that gets burnt into young Jeff's memory. And so of course, for the first couple of years working in this profession, I thought that was a thing that just had to be done, because I remembered it. But I was remembering it because it was so alien and out of my normal experience.
Huh. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. But my circle times that I remember were actually, I mean, we sang, we played instruments. I remember stories. We did movement. So I don't ever remember calendar time. It's probably why I have no sense of calendars today. but I don't know. I think that's it. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with a group of children getting together, but sure. What do we do? Like, we don't sit around and watch the weather together. We get together and we dance and we sing and we tell stories humans. And
maybe,
so I
maybe go out in the weather.
Yeah.
Go and experience the weather. Well, Stephanie, we're coming up on an hour of recording now. I think it's probably time to wrap this up, but I'm going to throw the invitation out there. If you want to come back and do some more episodes with me in the future. Off the top of my head, I was wondering if you thought we could maybe do 20 or 30 minutes on each one of those factors to go into them a little bit deeper for listeners at some point. Would that be something
that you think we would
be able to do?
Yeah. And maybe tie in more of the practical stuff that people could actually use.
Yeah. 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 Get, you know, really, really unpack it a little bit deeper. And we barely touched on fairy tales. I wrote down that I was wondering, I wanted to get into why you had that interest in fairy tales and where that came from. And so maybe that stuff we could delve into in the future if you had time to share.
I'm delighted to share anytime. It's always a pleasure to read your work, and it's even more of a pleasure to talk with you, Jeff.
That is very flattering and uncomfortable, because I'm got very low self-esteem. So it's nice to have people
things to me. I'll give you a little bit of agency here. Your sign is gray. it's useful. I refer to it often. How's that?
I appreciate that. I got an idea. I got an idea for the book. In this modern world, you need to start doing, look, I've never been on TikTok, but I hear it's what the young people like. You need to start doing just short little TikTok videos that share all this stuff for the young people. You need to become a TikTok star.
I know. I'm not sure about TikTok, but I have had it for the past several years. So my little fairy tale house has, I have a turret. And so I thought, tales for the turret. And I have thought about doing little short videos on YouTube. I don't know if I can do TikTok. I'm like, I'm too slow for TikTok.
I'm all completely off the social media, but you need to talk to our buddy Kristen Peterson, because she's very good at that stuff.
She is very good at her. I follow her stuff and I keep thinking, I'm not sure I could be that fast. she's very fast at those things. I'm a little more of a slow cooker, but yeah. I am thinking of that, because I think that people are afraid to use fairy tales.
And they're afraid to use turrets. I mean, people aren't making enough use of their turrets. So, I mean, if you got a turret, you don't want it to go to waste.
Use it.
So, anyway, Stephanie, where do people find, if people want more of you in their lives, where do they find you online? Where do they find the book?
My website is imaginationonthemove.com, just all imaginationonthemove, one word, .com. www or whatever it is, and that's where it's the best place to go to find all of the things. I have a weekly newsletter, hopefully weekly, that I just started, with fairy tales and how to develop resilience, just like one specific fairy tale, specific classroom activities that and why they build resilience. It's free. Website has blogs, it has like lots of references to Jeff's stuff because I think he's wonderful. And that's the I'm on social media. I'm on Facebook, Happily Ever Resilient. I'm on sort of on Instagram with Dr. Glitterway, but the website has everything, and that's probably the one place to go. And good, it has a link to how you can get in the book. So
excellent. Well, Stephanie, thank you for joining me. I love episodes. Well, look, just about every episode of this podcast, I feel a little bit smarter afterwards. So I'm glad you shared your information and your wisdom and your joy and love of this profession after spending so much time in it. Because, look, a lot of people get a little bit jaded and grouchy. And have you gone through a jaded and grouchy phase?
Not really. I mean, I left. I knew I was going to get there, sure. And I retired. I always said when I felt myself like not being able to jump around the classroom, even with my college students, and I didn't love jumping out of bed and getting to work, that was time for me to retire. And so I did. It would happen to be my retirement age, and then I got this new burst of energy to keep on in the field. And just today I volunteered for the first time at my local public library in the children's room. And
oh, that sounds delightful.
I had so much fun.
Well, in my mind, you are a very special unicorn, and I'm glad we've had this chance to connect. Listeners, this has been the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast, the world's longest running and most prolific early learning podcast with the words bar and grill in the title. I'll be back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.